Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today on the show, we hear reports from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, Alice Bryant brings us the program Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with an American story. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
A company known for shaping trends in color design has announced its color of the year for 2019. The winning color is called Living Coral. It is based on the look of healthy coral reefs in the world's oceans. The announcement came December 5th from Pantone, a company with offices in the American state of New Jersey. Pantone seeks to predict color trends and examine the psychological effects of color. The company advises major businesses on choosing colors for their products and advertising campaigns. Its color of the year can influence many different industries. These include beauty care, fashion, art, home, and product design. Pantone says its experts look around the world for color influences in these and other industries throughout the year. The company's Pantone Color Institute chooses the color of the year. Leatrice Eisman is the head of the institute. She says people in our busy and technological world seem to be craving human interaction and social connection. Corals are groups of small organisms called polyps. These polyps live within a hard skeleton made of limestone. Millions of corals grow together to form coral reefs. The reefs support many kinds of sea life. Coral reefs also support fishing activities and protect inland waterways. The color living coral, Eisman said, represents humanizing and heartening qualities that she thinks people will warmly receive. Color is an equalizing lens through which we experience our natural and digital realities, she added. And this is particularly true for living coral. Pantone's vice president, Lori Pressman, told the Associated Press, the company considers the 2019 color of the year warm and welcoming. The choice was especially important as human interaction seems to be decreasing in society, she said. With everything that's going on today, we're looking for those humanizing qualities because we're seeing online life dehumanizing a lot of things, she told the AP. Pressman added that the company believes people want colors that signal nourishment and comfort to make them feel good about themselves and the world. Living coral is an example of that, she said. It's not too heavy. We want to play. We want to be uplifted. Pressman added that while living coral is very bright and eye-catching, it is not so overpowering and in your face. The announcement comes at a time when rising water temperatures and human activities continue to harm coral reefs around the world. Such damage can remove the bright colors that represent coral as living, breathing things. A Pantone statement said that living coral represents the energizing elements found in nature. It said the color shows the power of coral reefs to provide shelter to a great kaleidoscope of color. I'm Brian Lynn.
Cat lovers know that the animals spend a lot of time cleaning themselves. Cats use their tongues to remove dirt from their fur and smooth out their hair. Scientists are now learning how the rough, sandpaper-like surface of cats' tongues helps the animal get clean and stay cool. The secret: small hooks that stand up on the tongue, with scoops, small rounded areas, built in to carry saliva deep into all that hair. A team of mechanical engineers reported the findings this month. They said their discoveries are more than unusual and could lead to inventions for people. A cat's tongue could help people put liquids or medicine on hairy skin, said lead researcher Alexis Noel of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Noel is seeking property rights for a three-dimensional printed tool that acts like the tongue. Cats spend up to 25% of their waking hours cleaning themselves. Noel said she became interested in the subject when her cat, Murphy, struggled to free his tongue from a soft blanket. Scientists had always thought that the tongue was rough because it had small, uneven bumps. Noel wondered why. First, computed tomography, CT, images of cats' tongues showed they are not raised areas, but small hooks with scoops at the end. The hooks are flat, but when cats need them for self-cleaning, they stand up, Noel explains. The scientific name for them is papillae. The Georgia Tech researcher found that the papillae take in liquid. A house cat has nearly 300 papillae that hold a small amount of saliva that is released when the tongue presses on fur. Noel saw evidence that the papillae helped the animals stay extra clean. Next, she examined the tongues of other cats in the species, like lions. Papillae were only a little longer in lions than in cats, noted Noel and David Hugh, an associate professor at Georgia Tech. Their findings were published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Next, Noel measured cat fur, which holds a lot of air to keep the animal warm. When the fur is pushed down flat against the cat's skin, the distance is the same as the length of the papillae, she discovered. The one exception was the fur of long-haired Persian cats. I'm Susan Shand.
Today, we will answer a question about two misunderstood modal verbs. Modal verbs are helping verbs. They help us express things like necessity, permission, ability, and possibility. For example, I can bring the bag tomorrow uses the modal verb can to express ability. Now, here is our question.
Hi, can you tell me the difference between must and have to?
Hello, Manuel. Thanks for writing. The modal verbs must and have to are very close in meaning. They both express a requirement or need to do something. First, let me tell you what grammar books say about these verbs. Then, I will tell you how we really use them. Grammar books say that must expresses that the speaker has decided that something is a requirement or necessity. And have to expresses that someone else has made something a requirement or necessity. An example would be a rule or law. But in the real world, we do not often separate the meanings this way. We use both modals to express that something is required or necessary.
I must, I have to, go to the doctor today.
Is a rule or law.
We have to, we must, pay off the loan by December.
Is very probable.
You have not slept since yesterday? You must, you have to, be tired.
Or to say that someone should do something.
You must, you have to, watch this show. It's so funny.
However, when speaking American English, we usually only use must to say that something is very likely. For all other meanings, it usually sounds too formal or official. And Americans rarely use must in questions except when criticizing someone.
Must you chew so loud?
And here is something to watch for. The negative forms of must and have to have completely different meanings. We use the negative of have to when something is not required or necessary.
You don't have to wash the dishes. I'll wash them.
But must not or mustn't means that something is banned or not permitted. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now it's time for an American story. Here is The Furnished Room by O. Henry.
Restless, always moving, forever passing, like time itself, are most of the people who live in these old red houses. This is on New York's West Side. The people are homeless, yet they have 100 homes. They go from furnished room to furnished room. They are transients. Transients forever. Transients in living place. Transients in heart and mind. They sing the song, Home Sweet Home. But they sing it without feeling what it means. They can carry everything they own in one small box. They know nothing of gardens. To them, flowers and leaves are something to put on a woman's hat. The houses of this part of the city have had 1,000 people living in them. Therefore, each house should have 1,000 stories to tell. Perhaps most of these stories would not be interesting. But it would be strange if you did not feel, in some of these houses, that you were among people you could not see. The spirits of some who had lived and suffered there must surely remain, though their bodies had gone. One evening a young man appeared, going from one to another of these big old houses, ringing the doorbell. At the 12th house, he put down the bag he carried. He cleaned the dust from his face. Then he touched the bell. It sounded far, far away, as if it were ringing deep underground. The woman who owned the house came to the door. The young man looked at her. He thought that she was like some fat, colorless, legless thing that had come up from a hole in the ground, hungrily hoping for something or someone to eat. He asked if there was a room that he could have for the night.
"Come in," said the woman.
Her voice was soft, but for some reason he did not like it.
"I have the back room on the third floor. Do you wish to look at it?"
The young man followed her up. There was little light in the halls. He could not see where that light was coming from. The covering on the floor was old and ragged. There were places in the walls made, perhaps, to hold flowering plants. If this were true, the plants had died long before this evening. The air was bad. No flowers could have lived in it for long.
"This is the room," said the lady in her soft, thick voice. "It's a nice room. Someone is usually living in it. I had some very nice people in it last summer. I had no trouble with them. They paid on time. The water is at the end of the hall. Sprouls and Mooney had the room for 3 months. You know them? Theater people. The gas is here. You see, there's plenty of space to hang your clothes. It's a room everyone likes. If you don't take it, someone else will take it soon." "Do you have many theater people living here?"
asked the young man.
"They come and they go. Many of my people work in the theater. Yes, sir. This is the part of the city where theater people live. They never stay long anyplace. They live in all the houses near here. They come and they go."
The young man paid for the room for a week. He was going to stay there, he said, and rest. He counted out the money. The room was all ready, she said. He would find everything that he needed. As she moved away, he asked his question. He had asked it already 1,000 times. It was always there, waiting to be asked again.
"A young girl, Eloise Vashner. Do you remember her? Has she ever been in this house? She would be singing in the theater, probably. A girl of mid-height, thin, with red-gold hair, and a small dark spot on her face near her left eye. No, I don't remember the name. Theater people change names as often as they change their rooms. They come and they go. No, I don't remember that one."
No. Always no. He had asked his question for 5 months, and the answer was always no. Every day he questioned men who knew theater people. Had she gone to them to ask for work? Every evening he went to the theaters. He went to the good theaters and to bad ones. Some were so bad that he was afraid to find her there. Yet he went to them, hoping. He who had loved her best had tried to find her. She had suddenly gone from her home. He was sure that this great city, this island, held her. But everything in the city was moving, restless. What was on top today was lost at the bottom tomorrow. The furnished room received the young man with a certain warmth, or it seemed to receive him warmly. It seemed to promise that here he could rest. There was a bed, and there were 2 chairs with ragged covers. Between the 2 windows there was a looking glass about 12 inches wide. There were pictures on the walls. The young man sat down in a chair while the room tried to tell him its history. The words it used were strange, not easy to understand, as if they were words of many distant foreign countries. There was a floor covering of many colors.
like an island of flowers in the middle of the room. Dust lay all around it. There was a bright wallpaper on the wall. There was a fireplace. On the wall above it, some bright pieces of cloth were hanging. Perhaps they had been put there to add beauty to the room. This they did not do. And the pictures on the walls were pictures the young man had seen 100 times before in other furnished rooms. Here and there, around the room, were small objects forgotten by others who had used the room. There were pictures of theater people, something to hold flowers, but nothing valuable. One by one, the little signs grew clear. They showed the young man the others who had lived there before him. In front of the looking glass, there was a thin spot on the floor covering. It told him that women had been in the room. Small finger marks on the wall told of children trying to feel their way to sun and air. A larger spot on the wall made him think of someone, in anger, throwing something there. Across the looking glass, some person had written the name Marie. It seemed to him that those who had lived in the furnished room had been angry with it and had done all they could to hurt it. Perhaps their anger had been caused by the room's brightness and its coldness, for there was no true warmth in the room. There were cuts and holes in the chairs and in the walls. The bed was half broken. The floor cried out as if in pain when it was walked on. People, for a time, had called this room home, and yet they had hurt it. This was a fact not easy to believe, but perhaps it was, strangely, a deep love of home that was the cause. The people who had lived in the room perhaps never knew what a real home was, but they knew that this room was not a home. Therefore, their deep anger rose up and made them strike out. The young man in the chair allowed these thoughts to move one by one, softly through his mind. At the same time, sounds and smells from other furnished rooms came into his room. He heard someone laughing in a manner that was neither happy nor pleasant. From other rooms he heard a woman talking too loudly. He heard people playing games for money. And he heard a woman singing to a baby. And he heard someone weeping. Above him there was music. Doors opened and closed. The trains outside rushed noisily past. Some animal cried out in the night outside. And the young man felt the breath of the house. It had a smell that was more than bad. It seemed cold and sick and old and dying. Then, suddenly, as he rested there, the room was filled with the strong, sweet smell of a flower, small and white, named Mignonette. The smell came so surely and so strongly that it almost seemed like a living person entering the room. And the man cried out aloud, "What, dear?" as if he had been called. He jumped up and turned around. The rich smell was near and all around him. He opened his arms for it. For a moment, he did not know where he was or what he was doing. How could anyone be called by a smell? Surely it must have been a sound. But could a sound have touched him? "She has been in this room," he cried. And he began to seek some sign of her. He knew that if he found any small thing that had belonged to her, he would know that it was hers. If she had only touched it, he would know it. This smell of flowers that was all around him, she had loved it and she had made it her own. Where did it come from? The room had been carelessly cleaned. He found many small things that women had left. Something to hold their hair in place, something to wear in the hair to make it more beautiful, a piece of cloth that smelled of another flower, a book. Nothing that had been hers. And he began to walk around the room like a dog hunting a wild animal.
He looked in corners. He got down on his hands and knees to look at the floor. He wanted something that he could see. He could not realize that she was there, beside, around, against, within, above him, near to him, calling him. Then once again he felt the call. Once again he answered loudly, "Yes, dear," and turned wild-eyed to look at nothing. For he could not yet see the form and color and love and reaching arms that were there in the smell of white flowers. Oh, God, where did the smell of flowers come from? Since when has a smell had a voice to call? So he wondered and went on seeking. He found many small things left by many who had used the room. But of her who may have been there, whose spirit seemed to be there, he found no sign. And then he thought of the owner. He ran from the room with its smell of flowers, going down and to a door where he could see a light. She came out. He tried to speak quietly.
"Will you tell me," he asked her, "who was in my room before I came here?" "Yes, sir, I can tell you again. It was Sprouse and Mooney, as I said. It was really Mr. and Mrs. Mooney, but she used her own name. You know, theater people do that."
"Tell me about Mrs. Mooney. What did she look like?"
"Black-haired, short and fat. They left here a week ago."
"And before they were here?"
"There was a gentleman, not in the theater business. He didn't pay. Before him was Mrs. Crowder and her two children. They stayed 4 months. And before them was old Mr. Doyle. His sons paid for him. He had the room 6 months. That is a year. And further, I do not remember."
He thanked her and went slowly back to his room. The room was dead. The smell of flowers had made it alive, but the smell of flowers was gone. In its place was the smell of the house. His hope was gone. He sat looking at the yellow gaslight. Soon he walked to the bed and took the covers. He began to tear them into pieces. He pushed the pieces into every open space around the windows and door. No air now would be able to enter the room. When all was as he wished it, he put out the burning gaslight. Then, in the dark, he started the gas again, and he lay down thankfully on the bed. It was Mrs. McCool's night to go out and get them something cold to drink. So she went and came back, and sat with Mrs. Purdy in one of those rooms underground where the women who own these old houses meet and talk.
"I have a young man in my third floor back room this evening," said Mrs. Purdy, taking a drink. "He went up to bed 2 hours ago."
"Is that true, Mrs. Purdy?" said Mrs. McCool. It was easy to see that she thought this was a fine and surprising thing.
"You always find someone to take a room like that. I don't know how you do it. Did you tell him about it?"
"Rooms," said Mrs. Purdy in her soft, thick voice, "are furnished to be used by those that need them. I did not tell him, Mrs. McCool."
"You're right, Mrs. Purdy. It's the money we get for the rooms that keep us alive. You have the real feeling for business. There are many people who wouldn't take a room like that if they knew. If you told them that someone had died in the bed and died by their own hand, they wouldn't enter the room."
"As you say, we have our living to think of," said Mrs. Purdy.
"Yes, it is true. Only 1 week ago I helped you there in the third floor back room. She was a pretty little girl, and to kill herself with the gas. She had a sweet little face, Mrs. Purdy."
"Yes, she would have been called beautiful, as you say," said Mrs. Purdy. "Except for that dark spot she had growing by her left eye. Do fill up your glass again, Mrs. McCool."
And that is our show. Join us again tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.